Blog Talk Radio.
My mind is clearer now. I have lost all too well. I can see where we all soon will be. If you strip away the myth from the man, you will see where we all soon will be. Jesus, you've started to believe the things they say of you. You really do believe this talk of God is true. And all the good you've done will soon get swept away. You've begun to matter more than the things you say. Listen, Jesus, I don't like what I see. All I ask is that you listen to me. And remember, I've been your right-hand man all along. You have set them all on fire. They think they found a new Messiah. And they'll hurt you when they find they're wrong. I remember when this whole thing began. No talk of God, then we called you a man. And believe me, my admiration for you hasn't died. But every word you say today gets twisted round some other way. And they'll hurt you if they think you've lied. Nazareth, your famous son, should have stayed a great unknown. Like his father carving wood, he'd have made good. Tables, chairs, and oaken chests would have suited Jesus best. He'd have caused nobody harm, no one alarm. Listen, Jesus, do you care for your race?
Don't yeah.
You see, we must keep in our place.
We must keep in our place.
We are occupied. Have you forgotten how put down we are?
Hold on. Let's talk about it. March 18th, 2011, Washington, D.C., the United States of America, planet Earth, third planet from the sun. We have a caller on the line, but before we get to the caller, we need to wrap up a little business. Obama. President. That's what we're going to call him now. I did call him the TOTUS, teleprompter of the United States of America, for his reading of the teleprompter to a group of fifth graders. What a moron. My dog could read to a group of fifth graders without using a teleprompter. One knock on Barack Obama in the 2008 election was his record as an Illinois state senator, which was abysmal. Yes, I use the word abysmal. Where he repeatedly ducked tough issues by voting present. It seems hard habits die hard. Caller, announce yourself. Who are you? Hello? Hello? Well, we'll have to get back to our caller. If you'd like to know where the leader of the free world stands on those NCAA rankings, then just turn on ESPN. I think Kansas has more firepower, he explained as he filled out his bracket, wondering what the commander-in-chief thinks about gun laws. Oh, don't worry. He's in favor of those already on the books, according to a recent op-ed. If, however, you're curious about where the most powerful man in the universe stands on Libya, radiation, and possible government shutdown? The future of Social Security or rising oil prices? And well, don't look to the White House for that. Those issues are tough. Those issues are risk mistakes. Those issues might mean unhappy voters. And right now, it's approval ratings the White House cares about. Obama advisors are spinning their excuses for the president's absence. He needs to stay above the fray, they say. And he believes in international agreement. Conservatives, for their part, are beginning to argue the incompetence line, and rightfully so. A combination of all is probably at work. You know, along with even greater impulse, political safety. Mr. Obama got a taste of falling approval ratings last year. The White House has worked hard to get those numbers back up and wants to keep them there until Mr. Obama has a GOP opponent and can go into campaign mode where he is at his best. Because in campaign mode, you really don't have to think. They just feed you the lines, and you just say them. Obama is an empty suit, and he's only really good at one thing, reading that teleprompter. But when it comes to making a decision, being and behaving presidential in a leadership capacity, well, Obama doesn't have the tools. And so, as Muammar Gaddafi has visited a bloodbath on opposition forces, the White House has for weeks spun its wheels at the United Nations, waiting for someone else to go first. The White House has argued intervention might provoke an Arab backlash against the U.S. Oh, and we can't have that. And it could be actually, could it actually, well, and could it be it actually believes such crazy talk? Yet it seems equally concerned that any U.S.-led military action in Libya, no matter how minor, will invite comparisons of the dreaded Bush warmongers and prove quite unpopular for the president because, after all, his poll numbers are dropping. Is there any wonder why? Is there any wonder why? And as Congress lurches from one budget crisis to the next, President Obama leaves negotiation to that inept moron number two, Vice President Joe Biden. It has been clear for weeks the only way this gets settled is for Mr. Obama and House Speaker John Boehner to find a fiscal 2011 spending cut number that gets bipartisan support. But Mr. Obama worries that number will be too much for the left and not enough for the right. And that means controversy. And we know that this president shies away from controversy, making the tough decision, making the hard decision, doing what's right. He can't do that. Because here, as I spoke with a friend earlier today, she happens to be black, or she might even refer to herself as African American. She is proud to have the first black president of the United States of America in the White House. How sweet. But I wonder how proud she is of the fact that he is lazy, inept, indecisive, has no leadership ability whatsoever, and is pretty much hedging his bets and playing it safe at the expense of American prestige here and abroad. I'm treating this country like it's his personal playground, spending our money on lavish vacations all over the world, all over the country and all over the world for him and his family and his cronies. I wonder how she feels about that. Because when you have, you know, there was this old saying in the black community where you have to work harder just to keep up. Well, you gotta work those extra hours just to keep up, just to get noticed. You have to work twice as hard to to get where you want to go. I guess that doesn't apply anymore. Certainly it doesn't apply to President Obama, because black folks are giving him a pass left and right. Barack Obama is making black people look bad. What is that old, you know, we're going to dispense with political correctness today. Today. It's all gone out the window. None, mind you. Now, think back to those old racist cartoons when you had a black, barefoot, tattered clothing underneath a shade tree with a bunch of watermelon on a wood pile. And he's snoozing. And he's got watermelon rinds all around it. Yeah, I've seen those cartoons. Now, fast forward, weren't they horrible. Now, fast forward now to our current president. Well, he's that Negro in the woodpile underneath the shade tree, but he doesn't have the watermelon rinds. No, he has Air Force One. He has lavish vacations. Him and his wife and his children and all of their crony friends are the equivalent of that Negro underneath the shade tree, snoozing with a full belly with watermelon rinds strewn all about. Barack Obama is that Negro. One would think that if you're the first black president of the United States, that you don't behave like some arrogant rube, spending money like a drunken sailor, hanging out, not doing your job, and people like my good friend Juan Williams making excuses for him, and Geraldo making excuses for him, saying, hey, you don't begrudge the president for having a few holes of golf. You don't begrudge the president. I mean, he works very hard. What kind of hard work has this clown been doing? How hard can it be to be the president of the United States of America? You live like a king. Do your job. But today, instead, he leaves for a 5-day Latin American tour. On that trip, he will not be visiting Colombia or Panama, whose trade deals he squelched since he took office. No, my brother. Trade deals? Well, after all, don't always sit well with the public, and rarely with unions. It took until yesterday, mind you, for Barack Obama to address Japan's nuclear problems, and only then to clarify that Americans should and should not be worried about radiation. A very confusing message. While also knowing that U.S. power plants are, while also noting that U.S. power plants are and aren't safe. While the president had been touting a new love for nuclear energy in order to coax Republicans into a clean energy deal, didn't work. But the White House is now worried Japan is the hydrogen version of the BP oil spill and thinking the safest short-term policy is incoherence. That's our president. That guy underneath the shade tree on a wood pile with watermelons strewn about. Mr. Lazy Ass. Mr. Indecisive. Oh, I don't know what else to do. I can make a decision, but if I make the wrong decision, I'm going to get in trouble. The voters aren't going to like me. Mr. Barack Hussein Obama, an embarrassment, not only to black folks everywhere, but to America in general. This guy is an embarrassment. How can you be arrogant and incompetent all at the same time? Usually arrogance is born out of you know, a certain cockiness, a certain, you know, a self-assuredness that you're doing the right thing. You know, Muhammad Ali had a certain amount of arrogance, a certain amount of cockiness, a certain amount of self-assuredness that was born out of achievement. And Barack Obama has done absolutely nothing but go on vacation time and time and time again. Let's play it.
Get up.
Darkness had descended all across the land. A lone voice in the distance uttered, "Yes, we can." He gave good speeches, never sweat. He was real good at the internet. He's Barack Obama, he's come to save the day. He passed a major stimulus for the bourgeois. They said he had the deficit.
Sir, we've got a situation.
That were true. Barack Obama's come to save the day, all right, in Rio de Janeiro. Oh my goodness. Entitlement reform. Let's talk about it. Are you people crazy? Whoever won an election on entitlement reform, Barack Obama probably would say. You know, the White House's greater interest right now seems to be throwing little bones to its left. A quip here about the Wisconsin labor dispute, a gun control op-ed there, a promise to quit defending the Defense Against Marriage Act. Yet, even these are tiny little bones. Designed not to hugely upset the broader public, because we wouldn't want to upset anybody. Careful is the word. Careful. Compare this to George W. Bush, who ordered an Iraqi surge despite dismal approval ratings, despite them. Say what you want about President George W. Bush, but at least he was a man of action. He did something. Well, this cowardly, inept president we are stuck with for the next 2 years, well, he's made a decision. He's decisive. He's going on vacation. Again. A present strategy. A present strategy. Didn't hurt the Illinois state senator. No, because he went on to become president. And that may be what's guiding the president's team now. Then again, you know, the White House is discovering there are greater consequences for a present president. The administration is realizing right now, for instance, that a victorious Gaddafi is not, in fact, to Mr. Obama's or the world's advantage. One reason is now it is now adopting a more aggressive posture. Well, too little, too late. Because Gaddafi just told President Barack Hussein Obama to go screw himself. Never before done to any president, not even George W. Bush. Under George Bush and every other Republican president, Gaddafi feared the United States of America, and we kept him in line and kept him in check. If Ronald Reagan were here today, George Bush Sr. or Jr., Gaddafi would have been where he should be, in his place. In his place. It hardly seems to me to be a winning strategy for the White House to keep the president's approval ratings below the 50% mark. You know, he needs at least 50% for re-election. The president in particular, you know, he risked alienating congressional Democrats who are wearying of being left to handle public criticism. If they start to believe the president is looking out only for himself, which he is, well, they're just going to do the same. Even if that means undermining pieces of Obama's agenda. There is another way, of course. One that I've given a lot of thought to. And that is the Americans who voted in 2008 didn't vote present. And they voted for a leader. I wonder if they'll reward President Obama this coming election. Now, try this for a timeline. Recent events that affect Americans, and see whether you can determine whether the leader of the free world suffers from presidential attention deficit disorder. Wednesday, March 9th. The 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, is alerted to deploy with all possible haste to the Mediterranean Sea, and be prepared for military and humanitarian contingency operations off the coast of Libya. That night, President Barack Hussein Obama hosted a TV party at the White House to watch a basketball game. It was the Chicago Bulls versus the Charlotte Bobcats. At least the Bulls won Thursday, March 10th. Forces loyal to Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi recapture the city of Zinawi from the rebels. French president. French. Do you hear me? I said French president. Nicolas Sarkozy. Oh my God. Formally recognize the Provisional National Council as the legitimate government of Libya, and urges other governments to send aid to the rebels. Rather than focus on these events, Obama convened the White House on conference the White House conference on bullying prevention. So he's focusing on bullying prevention while a damn Frenchman is putting his you-know-what on the table and saying, hey, this is how we're going to proceed. This is what we need to do. A Frenchman bested our president for gonads. How does that happen? When has it ever happened in American history where a damn Frenchman showed more balls and more leadership than the president of the United States of America? And I'll tell you what, Panky, the U.S. has every business meddling in the civil war in Libya. That's what we do. We choose sides. And we back the oppressed. We back people with good intentions. Oftentimes we back people with bad intentions if it suits our purpose. But in this case, Libya's Muammar Gaddafi has been a thorn in the side of the United States of America and the world for the last 30 years. For the last 30 years, it's time for him to go. Moving back to my timeline. Friday, March 11th. Shortly after midnight Eastern time, one of the largest earthquakes ever recorded in human history, an 8.9 magnitude, triggers a devastating tsunami, destroying whole cities on Japan's eastern coast. Teleprompter-in-chief, or POTUS, President of the United States, if you prefer. Well, his first public remarks on the potentially catastrophic disaster occurred at 12:35 p.m. exactly, at a previously scheduled news conference on energy policy. At 2:15 p.m., he hosted the 2010 Stanley Cup champions Chicago Blackhawks. Nobody mentioned the tragedy in Japan. This guy is a joke. Saturday, March 12th, European Union leaders, folks, resolve that Gaddafi surrender power and leave Libya immediately. An Israeli family of five, including three children, are brutally murdered by Palestinian terrorists. In Bahrain, the headquarters of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, Shiite protesters demand the ouster of King Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And police kill a half dozen anti-government protesters in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. That afternoon, Obama played golf before headlining the annual Gridiron Club dinner with Washington's elite. His prepared remarks, delivered from a podium-mounted teleprompter, of course, were deemed devastatingly funny and humorously self-deprecating. He barely mentioned any of the events occurring around the world or his golf score. Is there a pattern here? Anybody? We have a caller. Take the call. Yeah, caller, you're on the line.
How you doing tonight? This is Pianchi.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
You know, disregarding any of the inefficiencies of Barack Obama, I didn't call, but my point is that what business do they have in messing around with Libya? Libya is having a civil war now. For someone to say that you don't have Libyan citizens who are supporting Gaddafi, and what was protesters have now turned to rebels, is just totally inaccurate. And what are these protesters who are now rebels? What is their gripe? Libya had the highest standard of living in any country on the continent of Africa. They had so much work going on that you had over 1 million immigrants from Egypt working in Egypt, in Libya, just alone, not including the other ethnic groups. So,
well, those are all great questions. What I would suggest is that, and from what I'm gathering from the various news organizations, Reuters, AP, and those, is that the people of Libya are simply tired of an autocratic rule. They would prefer something a bit more democratic. Libya's Muammar Gaddafi is a hoodlum and a thug, and he seems to be terribly unstable, as even probably you would admit, based on those rantings and ravings. The people of Libya are tired of that sort of rule.
Well, Jerry Strong was a thug, too. Let's put him in that category also, but you still gave him about $4.5 billion a year. But there's other than the – I mean, when you vow to try to overthrow a government, it's just not going to work in many cases. How can you support – if a government has all the right in the world to – suppress these type of resurrections. I mean, look at the riots they had in Detroit where they brought in the 82nd Airborne. And now we can go on and name many other instances that have happened throughout the history of this country. Now, whatever the situation is with Muammar Gaddafi, I can understand it, but the type of action that those people use, you know, that group used in order to try to change things was totally wrong.
Well, it's my understanding that, and maybe you can clarify this for me, that the demonstrations didn't start out to be violent. And they were simply those days of rage where there would be a gathering, much like what occurred in Egypt, and then Muammar sought to put down the demonstrations with violence himself at the beginning. Is that not correct, or have I read the situation the wrong way? Have I been given bad information?
I think Gaddafi was more surprised than anybody else that the things went down the way they did. It was something else. Britain is not going to put no troops on the ground. Really, United States not either. They can't afford to. The one country that has a lot at stake is France. France is about on her back. Libya is a CFA country. France is having problems with the CFA. You got African countries that's talking about dumping the CFA, and France is trying to hold on to her monetary well-being, which I don't think is going to happen. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't think there's no troops going to go on the ground there, but it'd be interesting to see, you know, what happens.
Well, I think America's role, along with the rest of the countries that are armed against Libya, they simply want there not to be a slaughter of the people of the rebellion. I spoke about this on my show yesterday about how freedom fighters in Cuba against Fidel Castro were promised nothing more than air support from the U.S. During the Kennedy administrations, and they would do the rest. And at the very last minute, air support was pulled, and there was a mass slaughter. And Kennedy never did live that down, right up until his death. And I think all that these rebels, for lack of a more appropriate title, are asking for is some air cover so that they're not slaughtered, and they'll do the rest.
I don't think all they got to do is put their guns down and their weapons down and solve this problem in a civilized way.
And you suggest that? Hold on. Let me ask you this. Do you honestly believe that Muammar Gaddafi is going to say, "Hey, well, you know what? All is forgiven. We're all good."
Well, you know, Gaddafi has been very supportive of many African countries in the past, you know, with apartheid, South Africa came to the aid of Ghana, he came to the aid of a couple other countries, which I just can't name right now.
Well, I understand that, but do you think that if the people of his own country who have rebelled against him lay down their weapons and surrender, that he's just going to let it slide?
Well, if he doesn't, you know, it would be a more tantamount to apply that type of action against people who's defenseless than it is now when people got guns trying to shoot you. And, John, these people was trying to kill, you know, Gaddafi's, not only his military, but also the citizens of Libya who are pro-Gaddafi. They was trying to kill them, too.
Let me ask you, what do you think of President Obama's willingness to suggest, to state, and state emphatically that the leader of Egypt had to go and needed to go quickly, and how he is waffling on Gaddafi leaving or staying? What do you think of that?
Well, you know, there's probably four or five true warriors that's left in this world today. Gaddafi is one, Mugabe, Castro, Hugo Chavez, and probably Morales there in Bolivia.
Warriors, and what do you mean by warriors?
Well, people who, when they say they're going to take their country back, they mean exactly that. They have got to the position, they had fought colonialism in the past, and they have fought attempts by, you know, former colonial governments to try to cause all sorts of havoc within their country. I mean, look what's going on in Cote d'Ivoire. Here you got France, who participated in the election, is backing, I can't think of Ouattara, against Gbagbo. Why don't they just have another election? France is fighting for her, you know, France has got to, is going to be on her butt. But it'd just be interesting to see exactly what happens. I don't think any foreign troops going to go in there. When do you stop? You know, France had this same type of problem a couple of years ago. There was no imposing a no-fly zone over Russia when it bombed the hell out of Georgia.
Why do you think that the majority of countries are aligned against Gaddafi, and only, I think there were four abstentions, China, Russia, and... Right.
It's funny about that, too, for the Arab countries to do what they've done. But, Saudi Arabia... you know, the other Arab countries don't like the way Saudi Arabia carries on things. That's something within those people's culture. And I think that, you know, as long as they just not outright massacring people like you've seen in some other, you know, look at Clinton, what he done to the Serbians.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do you think there is, it seems to be citizens of these various Middle East countries rising up almost in concert against their leadership?
Oh yeah,
I mean, it's happening all over the Middle East. Is it? Do you believe that? Would you say that there's a concerted effort? That there's a concerted effort on the parts of citizens of these various Middle East countries acting in concert to overthrow their leadership?
Well,
I think
a lot of things has to do with the economy. You know, like, for instance, Egypt, you had a lot of college-educated Egyptians who couldn't find any work. And I think that there's a frustration. It wasn't poverty. Hell, of the 12 countries in that part of the world that has a possibility of either protesting or have protests, only two of them have an unemployment rate that's higher than, you know, blacks in America. And that is Egypt, not Egypt, but Libya and Yemen. Their poverty rate, you have ethnic groups here in America that have a higher poverty rate in some states than what you see in some of the countries over there. So I think that you got people who have college education who don't see themselves going any place. But guess what? I have been reading some articles, and I don't know about you, where it said that America needs no more college graduates. The report said there's 17 million Americans with college degrees who are not working at that degree level. they're taking medium jobs, dishwashers, cooks, and so on and so on. So surely that type of frustration here in the United States that we see going on over there has is being felt here. And with the austerity that's been going on, look what's going on in Wisconsin. And we're talking about other states that's going to follow Wisconsin as far as trying to subjugate state workers, public workers, whereas they don't have any bargaining rights.
Hold on. I mean, I'm going along with you, you know, right up until you said something that wasn't actually factual, and that is, that they have bargaining rights. They have bargaining rights. They just the bargaining rights are limited to salary, and not
okay.
benefits. And the reason, and you know the reason.
I stand to be corrected.
And you know, here's the thing. Now that we've moved on, we've moved back here to the United States of America. We don't have any money, but there are folks out there, and I don't know if you're one of them, who don't believe that we're broke. And
well,
that's
been broke a long time.
Exactly. We have been broke a long time, and there's a reason for that, and it's because one of the reasons, not completely, but one of the reasons is that these unions are breaking the budgets because
I don't think unions are breaking the budget. You know, if it wasn't for unions, you wouldn't have the middle class that you had, especially coming out of World War II and also after the thing that was going on in Vietnam. But when you got the United States spending money, here you had Hillary. I don't know. Hillary made a statement yesterday to Egypt that the United States would give Egypt $90 to $100 million in order to help them come out of their economic condition. Well, that's a slap in the face to Americans. Look at the unemployment. You got Americans who's facing foreclosure still, yet this coming up summer. You got high rates of unemployment. You got poverty in the southern states that's, you know, off the charts. You got crazy things will continue to go on in the school. I think the government should get out of public schools. But, you know, you got schools in some of your urban areas that's going to get back up to 40, 50, and 60 students per classroom.
Well, you know what? The United States of America, and this, and what you just said about Hillary, in my opinion, I'm not trying to spin it. I'm not. It's going to sound that way. It just simply speaks to the problem that we have in government with both Republicans and Democrats willing to spend money that we don't have to spend. Now, yeah, they can come up with $100 million somehow to give to this country or that country, but that's just piling up more and more debt. It seems to be the belief, in my opinion, that here in the United States that there are those who simply refuse to believe that the United States will and is insolvent or will be at some very future date, very, very nearby. You know, I heard Michael Moore said that, hey, we're not broke. You know, we've got millionaires and billionaires out there. Well, what, you know, if you do the math, very rudimentary math, very basic math, if you took all the money away from every single millionaire and billionaire in this country, if you just confiscated all their jack, it wouldn't even make a dent, not even a significant dent in our debt.
So, unfunded debt. You're absolutely right. The unfunded debt is probably over $100 trillion. If you took all the assets that the U.S. have, all our houses, cars, boats, took our schools, took our underwear, the value of that would not, you know, cover the total debt that this country is facing, especially the unfunded debt when you talk about Social Security and other entitlement programs.
So then why does the government continue to spend?
I don't understand it, and I don't understand why come American citizens continue to let that type of behavior go on. You know, for Hillary to make the statement that she did about giving Egypt $100 million when you got people in the Gulf states still are suffering and haven't been settled with BP with the oil spill. You still got people there that's still waiting to be settled with Katrina. And we can go on and on and on.
Well, Well, you know what? I have the idea that America is on the brink of insolvency, and I think that there are a lot of people out there. You know, let me just change direction for just a minute. The people in Congress, that the elected officials in Congress and in the Senate and in government in general, they're either really, really stupid, you know, or they've decided that, well, it don't matter. Let's just spend because we're all going to die. Let's just spend and just let nature run its course. It has to be that way because why else? Why not? If you love this country and if you love our way of life, our country, why wouldn't you do what's best for it, even if it hurts?
Well, you said a key word there, our way of life. The way of life that I'm afraid that Americans have been experiencing is going to change very drastically. And the boast that a country has so many millionaires really should be an embarrassment because to make a millionaire, you had to treat a lot of people wrong. And I'm sure that you would agree that the cost of living, just what it costs to live in America, is totally too much when you look at what people in other parts of the world is getting by on. So there's just going to have to be some changes.
I agree with the latter of your statement, but I don't agree that becoming a millionaire that you have to do that. I mean, you think about I can just rattle off the guys who the two college students who invented Facebook. You know, somebody wrote a check to them for, you know, billions of dollars, and they gave them
money. That's a innovation, which, you know, has some legitimacy. But when you look at the people that's on Wall Street and look at the type of money that they're pulling down, look at the type of money that your CEOs here in the United States make compared to a China CEO, for instance. And when a China CEO screw up, you know, it's nothing to pick up the paper the next morning and see where he committed suicide because he has so much pride in his country that he shamed it and he feel he deserved not to live any longer.
Yeah, China's a completely different country. There, I mean, everything's run by the government. We don't have that kind of system here. I'll tell you this. You know, I own my own company, and you know, when I started my company. And I started my business. I did it with my own money. I risked my own money to start my own business. Exactly. And when you start a business and you hire people, you're taking all the risk because the people that you hire and you pay their salaries and you pay their health care bills and Medicare, all that, and you incur all of these risks. The risks just pile up. The bigger your company gets, the more risk you inherit as a result. To be rewarded for employing people and for making greasing the wheel, making the economy work, creating payroll taxes, and all those things that you create as a result of starting a business, I mean, how are you hurting anybody by innovating, by taking a risk just so you can make money and have a better life for yourself? And along the line, down the road, you're helping other people as well. Because you're employing them. And I see that,
well,
you know, go on.
I see what you're saying, and I agree with you. But there's, I mean, we're looking at the one end of the spectrum compared to the other end of the spectrum. And when you look at, for instance, the cost that you're paying for food, which is even with the giant agriculture companies being subsidized to the hilt, you know, much of your illegal immigration is due to the fact that this government subsidized giant agri companies like your ADMs and your Con Eric, whereas they can grow crops in the Middle West and be able to take those crops down into South America and dump them on the market where local people farmers can't compete, and those workers will migrate up here and go to those very states where those farms are, those corporate farms are, work on those farms. And those states have minimum wage, which is exempt to that particular type of activity. So that there is a crime in itself.
Well, when the government puts its hands in anything private sector, I submit there's a crime being committed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and these wars are not for the benefit of the people. Look at how the money that's been spent in Iraq, close to $900 billion, and the money that wasn't even accounted for. I mean, look at the money that the Pentagon have lost, you know, close to what, $3 trillion over a period of time, can't give account to. I mean, that's just totally ridiculous, the things that's going on. Look at Kellogg Brown and Root paid $20 billion for supplying food per the Pentagon's auditors. In 2007, $20 billion for just supplying food for the troops. So, and why is it always these same ones? Halliburton, Kellogg Brown and Root, and I'm sure you can name a couple of them. I mean, your company, wouldn't you like to have an opportunity to be able to make money in situations like that?
Yeah, I would. But I am also very leery of any form of government subsidy coming my way or having the government be involved in any way at all in the dealings of my company. And in order to be supplemented by the government, then the government has to have a foot in the door. I mean, they want their piece of the pie. And I'm not just talking about the taxes either.
Yeah, so, but you can't tell me that Iraq was worth $900 billion. I mean, you could have gave every man, woman, child in Iraq $1 million, and they would have done anything that you wanted.
Well,
but the way it is now, according to the Brookings Institute, 82% of Iraq is opposed to the coalition troop presence. You had only 1% believe that the coalition forces responsible for the security improvement, and 67% feel less secure. So tell me, what did United States citizens get for $900 billion in Iraq?
Well, absolutely nothing. And it might surprise you that I did not agree with President Bush sending us to war there. I did agree with the first Desert Storm and Desert Shield and then Desert Storm. I was a part of that. I was there for almost 2 years on and off. But the second war in Iraq with W, I didn't agree with that. I didn't think it was necessary. Being a warrior myself and being a Marine for, you know, just about 30 years, it was 28 years and a few months, and being in countless battles over that time period, and being wounded several times, you know, I am of the mindset that the United States of America should only go to war when it's being directly threatened.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And let me ask you something. You were lucky, but how many of your buddies you know that was wounded, came back in terrible shape, and once they're here, they're being treated like dogs?
Of course, a great many, and that's one, and that's just another reason why I did not agree with going to Iraq. I don't believe that we're being threatened there. I do believe that after time had lapsed, that Saddam Hussein would be deposed and by his own people. It would just be a matter of time. It was unnecessary. I'd like to turn to something else. I did research for a History Channel special called Prophets of Doom. And anybody who's listening right now, I'd like you to, you know, take some time out this weekend if you could and look that up and watch it, if you will, DVR it. It speaks to several scenarios as to how the United States of America ultimately will meet its end as we know it. And I did a lot of research for the folks on the panel there, and it's a really good eye opener. I mean, it's actually quite sad, because a lot of things that they talk about that will cause America's downfall are happening right now in the news every single day. So it's a doomsday scenario. or series of doomsday scenarios as to how America will ultimately change forever and not for the better. So you should check that out if you haven't already seen it.
I will. And you know, I'm gonna leave you with this: that Pentagon has more power than you know we people even imagine. Pentagon, a place like the Federal Reserve, and you know, you look at your commanders. When your commanders come out, they go into the Pentagon. When they leave the Pentagon, they go into corporate, into the corporate world. Pentagon has got a lot of evilness that's going in there that's causing a lot of the problems that we have. Obama, you know, with the inefficiencies that he has, but when it comes down to that particular entity, no matter if it's Obama or Reagan or Bush or Clinton, you know, they have a trump card that they throw on the table that causes everybody else to pick up their hand. So I just wanted to say that, look, keep up the good work, man.
Hey, thank you very much, and you have a wonderful evening and a great weekend. I really do appreciate the call. It was a great call. All right. Let's see. We're gonna close out the show with one of the scenarios that could possibly happen here in the near future. Well, a scenario that's actually happening right now. I'm going to go ahead and close the show with it and end the show with it. Those of you who want to stay and listen, that's great. But otherwise, if I don't hear from you, y'all have a great weekend. Thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it. It's been great. Echo, thank you for being here. Billy, and even Robert Jones, and everybody else who's listening, thank you so much. I'm going to close it out with this.
The following is a fictional story of events that may happen in the near future. 8 a.m., New York Stock Exchange. It's a cold, breezy day on Wall Street as markets await the Federal Reserve's announcement for QE4. Futures are up significantly. The Dow Jones just breached its 2008 high of 14,164. Gold just hit an all-time high of 2,900. Silver just breached $100 per ounce. The dollar index is holding at 53. With official unemployment at 16.3%, there's a nervous feeling on Wall Street that if this doesn't work, the world could implode into a depression that will last for the remainder of the decade. 8:19 a.m., Beijing. Chinese officials announced that they can no longer allow Washington to devalue their holdings. After making their concerns private, China accepts that Washington will never stop paying its debts with inflated currency. China makes an official statement from Beijing, quote, "We have made our concerns known privately for some time. With QE4 about to be announced today, China will have no choice but to stop purchasing U.S. treasuries. We have allowed Washington to try to work through their imbalances for 4 years. But with global inflation and U.S. consumers rapidly shrinking as a percentage of global GDP, we feel that a Western recovery is unlikely until they reform their entitlement programs." 8:45 a.m., New York Stock Exchange. Upon hearing the statement from China, Dow futures have a sharp reversal and begin to drop. Gold leaps past $3,000 per ounce, up $150 per ounce in the last 26 minutes. CNBC awaits a statement from the White House. 8:50 a.m., Washington, D.C. The president makes an official statement to calm investors' fears. He tells Americans that he has spoken with several G20 leaders. They have assured him that they will continue to increase their purchase of treasuries and believe that a strong U.S. economy is the only thing that will bring back global prosperity. He has also spoken to Chairman Bernanke, who assures him that a strong dollar will be the result of G4. The president also reminds Americans that his recent New Deal recovery programs that he passed through executive order will increase the likelihood of a lasting recovery. He also notes that Beijing, since 2009, has slowly been reducing their holdings, so the impact will be minimal. 9:51 a.m., New York. Dow futures fall 850 points in the first 20 minutes of trading. Markets are halted for 1 hour by the authorities. 10 a.m., Main Street, America. The news about the stock market in China has now spread. A panic begins to set in, and unprepared Americans rush to the grocery store. In an attempt to purchase food and water, Americans that didn't know what was going on are alerted by all of the news stories and panic buying. Within 50 minutes, there is a nationwide rush to the stores. Empty store shelves in America become a reality. 10:52 a.m., New York. Markets reopen and the Dow Jones resumes its collapse. Investors around the world join the sell-off in bonds and stocks and begin to purchase commodities. Unlike the panic of 2008, this time commodities are seen as the only safe haven from a dollar crisis. 11:30 a.m., New York. The Dow falls 1,700 points since reopening. Trading has halted for at least 2 hours. The Federal Reserve injects $200 billion into the markets and announces that QE4 will be delayed until further notice. Congress has called back to D.C. for an emergency joint session. Some members of Congress are saying that they consider China's statement a financial attack. 12 p.m., Main Street, America. Several cities begin to see civil unrest after grocery stores are forced to close. Traffic in the streets and violence break out. The president puts the National Guard on alert for a possible deployment onto U.S. streets if things don't get under control soon. Several news agencies are reporting injuries at grocery chains and call for the authorities to do something before it gets worse. 12:15 p.m., Toronto, Canada. George Soros tells CNBC that a run on treasuries is imminent and that there is nothing the government can do to stop it. He says it is unfortunate that a controlled decline of the dollar was not coordinated better over the years. Today really could have been avoided if not for the Tea Party politicians who demanded fiscal responsibility and a constitutional government. 3 p.m. Gold closes at $11.53 for the day at $4,053 per ounce. Silver closes at $173 per ounce. The president announces that due to civil unrest in some areas of the country, U.S. stock markets will remain closed for the rest of the day. With the exception of mining and other inflation-related stocks, the majority of U.S. stocks are down significantly due to the sell-off and flight to safety in commodities. The Federal Reserve announces that it will begin to purchase U.S. treasuries and stocks in order to stabilize the market. But this only feeds investors' fears of a full-blown treasury run and collapse of the dollar. 6 p.m., Asia. Asian markets begin a massive sell-off. Dollar collapse rumors begin to take hold of the market. CNBC Asia looks into a possible COMEX default and complete breakdown in the U.S. economy. Gold spikes in Asia, up 1750 in the first complete hour of trading. Gold is now at 5803. 7 p.m., gold and silver bullion dealers across the world have suspended all sales due to no inventory. A COMEX default is now expected. Several central bank representatives propose a freeze on currency markets and a fixed devaluation of the U.S. dollar in order to calm investors. 7:30 p.m., the United States. The sun sets on America. In the last 12 hours, the world has changed. Americans are glued to their televisions, taking a crash course on a debauched currency. Smoke from fires in the cities have put a dark cloud over the nation. 7:45, the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve announces it will inject $1.5 trillion into the markets in order to stop any further decline in stocks. 7:55 p.m., OPEC. The final nail in the coffin. OPEC nations halt oil trades in U.S. dollars until further notice. They will only accept euros, renminbi, or gold. 7:59 p.m., the Federal Reserve's announcement to inject $1.5 trillion into the markets causes a sharp reversal in overseas markets. Stocks begin to rally even as Main Street melts down. 8 p.m., Manhattan. Gerard Adams, president of the National Inflation Association, sends out an urgent email alert. In it, he informs members that it is with great sadness that the time to warn and prepare Americans for hyperinflation has ended.